Yeah. Hi, good evening, everyone. This is Gordon, W2, Tango, Tango, Tango. Just reduce that echo just a hair. There we go. All right, so this is Gordon, W2, Tango, 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 and this is the Bergen Amateur Radio Association Technical Net. All stations are welcome to participate in the net. You only need a license that allows you to transmit in the amateur radio 2-meter band in these here United States of America. The net is run weekly on Thursday nights at 9 p.m., courtesy of the Chestnut Ridge Radio Club that operates repeaters on 146.955 and 442.900, both with a PL of 141.3 in Alpine, New Jersey. At this time, I don't believe the Echo Link is available via K2FJ link. That will return to service shortly, and there'll be some other good surprises coming up for the TechNet in the not-too-distant future. Alrighty, are there any stations with emergency or priority traffic? Please call K2 Bravo Alpha Romeo. Alrighty, the purpose of the TechNet is to engage in a dialogue. That means a conversation among peer participants. This is not a Gordon does a soliloquy for an hour on Thursday night's exercise. I'm more than capable of doing that. It's proven by any rational group of people that that's not the ideal way to proceed. So, we're going to need your participation. In order to get you to participate, we all need your call sign, your name, and whether or not you have a question or comment or none of the above. While we welcome questions and comments, we also welcome none of the above. We want to know who's out there, so please do check in. Again, the PL is 141.3. Sometimes it's coded as 4A. It's in standard Motorola codes, but in any case, 141.3 is the tone. We hope you will join us. So, without further ado, let's see where we can go with this net tonight. I know we're also going to have some special features tonight. We have one of our topics, by the way, is going to be the use of amateur radio, what do you call it, by people who are, should we say, being compensated, paid, if you will, to be on the air. And there's some issues with that, and we'll talk about that. As to what the rare, I mean very rare exceptions might be. And we're also going to talk a little bit about how you can support, other kinds of public service activities using amateur radio and what kinds of technical gear you might need to consider having. What kind of technical gear you might consider having in order to do that. So we'll be talking about those two topics, one in relation to a search and rescue activity, and the other one is I'm having trouble here. I guess my finger is a light touch on this mic. I've got to watch that. So anyway, we'll talk about those matters later. So in order to begin, we'll need your call sign, your name, and whether or not you have a question or comment for the net. We will start with the call signs beginning with Alpha. Hope Springs Eternal that we'll have an Alpha call sign here. Please call K2 Bravo Alpha Romeo. Alright, I didn't hear any alphas. Let's try November's tonight. November stations with your call sign, your name, whether or not you have a question or a comment, or none of the above. Please call K2BAR.
K2BAR? This is N2OEL. Two questions.
Two questions. Wow. Get a bonus. Good. Alrighty. Thank you, Noel. Any other Novembers?
Sis. NS2K Jim. No question at this point.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Jim. Any other Novembers? Alright, let's go to the Kilo stations. Kilo stations have been long neglected. Any Kilo station, knock yourself out. call sign name, and whether or not you have a question or comment or none of the above. Please call K2BAR.
K20, Jim. No comments, no questions at this time.
Good evening, James. And any other kilos?
Listening to the Yankees.
Yeah, well, there's nothing to watch. It's a baseball game. You only need the 30-second highlights of the whole game. All righty. Thank you, Tony. Any other kilos?
K2DSL, David. No questions, no comment, no confusion.
You lie. Good evening, David. Any other kilos? All righty. How about we'll try whiskey stations. Any whiskey station?
This is W2JEK, Don. No question.
Okay, Don. Very good evening to you. All right. Any other stations who have not checked in, please call K2BAR. Would you call sign your name and whether or not you have a question or a comment? Or none of the above.
This is WE2R, Charlie. No questions or comments.
Good evening, Charlie. All righty. Good to hear you. And, you know, I like this microphone. I just have to remember to actually talk into it. It's an Icon mic. It's an Icon hand mic. And unlike my Elinco's, it's not super hot, which is interesting. But anyway, I like the general clarity of the modulation. Alrighty. Good evening to you, Charlie. And the other stations.
This is KC2VLZ. David, no questions, no comments. So I've got about 10 minutes to listen.
Yeah, right. No questions, no comments.
Okay, VLZ, I need your name.
David, no questions, no comments.
All right, I need Tom's call sign. Who is Tom?
KUDAR, this is Tom, K2SB-0-Bravo-2-Echo-Sierra-Echo.
Hey, Tom, we've worked before. Very nice to hear you. All right. Very good. Got you. Any other stations? All right, let's get to our questions then. N2OEL, your question, sir, K2BAR.
Okay, K2BAR, this is Toya. Actually, I got three questions. Question one, which I had previously planned, was I have a J-pole that I want to use at the upcoming marathon. I want to stick it in a piece of 3/4-inch PVC water pipe. I'm wondering whether it will detune the antenna much by sticking it into that, and in which direction. Will I go up in frequency, down in frequency, stay the same, but have some weird reactants? Who knows? That's question number one. Question number two. If you have a quarter wave J-pole that feeds into a half wave, of course, for 2 meters, it appears to work very nicely on 440. And yet, when you look at it, I would think that the feed point should be moved down a bit to be accurately for 440, but that's not the case. And I'm just curious if that would make a difference. The third question is a little bit weird. I'm sitting here and look at the two tuners. One of them, when I turn the inductor, is so quiet you can't even hear it. The other one, okay, that's not the bearing. I lubricate the bearing with a fine light machine oil. It's the center roller on the roller inductor that's fitting on that shaft, and it's also whatever the roller is against the roller conductor itself. So I'd like to lubricate it, but I know that if I put something stupid on it, I'm going to screw up this tuner. It happens to be an MFJ differential T tuner, model 986. What would I properly do, lube roller that contacts the inductor and then slides down the shaft, and of course it has the center from the center of that shaft to the conductance is the contact, and I don't want to screw it up. So I'll say back to you. KWBF, this is Antilio.
All righty. We're going to leave that last question for last, because I think that the other ones are probably more interesting. It's my understanding that if you stick the J-pole inside of a PVC tube, once you've tuned it, that it will go lower in frequency, so therefore you would have to create a shorter J-pole and then place it in the tube in order to get it down on the right frequency you want. So you want to cut it for, well, you can experiment, but the story goes is that that when you stick it inside the PVC, that you lower the resonant frequency. You're adding, I guess some stray capacitance, but I don't understand how. But neither here nor there. But maybe somebody explain that. That's what I've been told. That J-poles that are put in PVC tubes are shorter than the norm. And someone may want to challenge me on that, and that would be fine. And the other question, which I'm going to address, we're going to address the roller inductor separately. The other question, which is, if you have a J-pole for 2 meters, yeah, it'll work fine generally on 432 or thereabouts. That's good news. Have some interesting radiation pattern, but it will work. It will load up. And you're asking why is it you can't move the feed down. I think it has to do with how the ZEP is actually, I mean, it's basically like a ZEP. So I'm going to defer to my antenna maven, Mr. K2ZO, although NS2K and I have discussed this offline, but I think we're going to try K2ZO to see what he might wish to dish at this point. Jim, over to you.
Okay, I'll let it drop. Okay, K2BAR, this is K2ZO. Well, if you take a look at the way the J-pole antenna is made, the J-pole antenna is really a half wavelength long antenna. And we all know that when you try to measure the impedance of a half wavelength antenna out at the end, very hard to do, by the way, but anyway, it is very high, take my word for it. And in order to couple low impedance RF into it, 50 ohms, that's coming out of the radio, you use a quarter wave section of line. Okay, so if we take a quarter wave section of line, and really doesn't have to be any particular impedance. But if you take a quarter wave section of line and look at it, one end, if you short, it'll be low, obviously. The other end will be high. That's what a quarter wave length of line does. It transforms the impedance. So what's happening is you've taken a quarter wave length of line, putting it on this thing, shorting it at the far end, down at the bottom, and it's high on the other side. Now what you're doing is, of course, tapping on the thing in order to get a match. And what you're doing is starting off at the zero point, which is right where it's shorted, obviously, and then moving up until you get a match for 50 ohms. Let's see, are we happy with that?
Question?
No.
Okay, on 2 meters I get it. On 432, let's say, it leaves me a little cold in that shouldn't, you know, at the 400 meg frequency, every half wave along that now three-quarter wave transformer, shouldn't the same impedance appear at those 2 points, and I'd have my choice?
I'm not sure you understood. You're talking about now using it on 450?
Right. What Noel's point was that if I take my 2 meter J-pole at the normal feed point, it will work pretty well on four, you know, at triple the frequency without moving the feed point. His question is, can he move the feed point down for 432 only and still get the same effect? In other words,
roughly a half wave down that transformer toward the shorting stub, that same impedance should be manifest again. And shouldn't that work? And if not, why doesn't it?
Yes, I think it could. I think it will. However, you won't get it to work on 2 meters then. You won't get the good match there. Because remember, we're repeating on the 450 antenna, we're repeating. So on the 450, because we have three, let's see, what is it, three times? Yeah. So we have three half waves. So that basically you probably could find another lower portion down where it would work on 450. It is just because what happens is that you're moving it along and you're going to see a low impedance point and it's going to go high and it's going to go back low again. So yeah, you could. But a generic 2 meter does work on 450 rather well.
Okay. Well, good. For this moment, then I feel smart again. All right, by the way, Devils are up 2-1 with like a minute change left. They just scored. Anyway. All right, let's see. All right, very good. So that answers that question. What does it do to the radiation pattern when, you know, I mean, we already know that, you know, with the same feed point, with the original feed point, what I call the 2 meter feed point, on 432, it, or thereabouts, it tends to have a high angle of radiation because you're stacking three half waves without phasing, you know, on top of each other. So it's going to have a high angle takeoff. So when you move the feed point down the transformer, if you will, does that change the feed, the radiation pattern of the antenna at all? Because you're tapping into the transformer at a different place.
No, you're matching it. That's all you're doing there. That whole bottom section is not a radiator at all. So matching an antenna in a different method, whether you take an antenna and feed it with 50 ohm or 450 or whatever and use an antenna tuner or whatever, does not change its radiation pattern, except in a couple of cases, which I could relate to you. But if you want to take a look at what happens, take a look in the handbook. Take a look at what happens when you feed a 40-meter antenna on 15 meters. Okay, so basically this is the same analogy. And what you have with the original resonant frequency is basically the radiation pattern of a dipole, except in this case it's in vertical position. But when you go to the multiple wavelength, now you get a number of different lobes. And yes, some of them are very high, but there'll be some lower ones. But if you look in the handbook, you can see what that pattern looks like.
Okay, good. That's awesome. That is awesome. All right. I think Mr. Jackson and I are feeling smart again because you've endorsed our conjecture, and you're the guru. So, let's see if there are any other comments from anybody else. Mr. Don.
I happen to be one of those people that uses a 40-meter dipole on 15 meters. And the instead of having the normal dipole pattern on 15 meters, you go to having an X-type pattern, which is about 44, 45 degrees away from the wire. But there is a small lobe exactly perpendicular to the wire. If you look at one of those charts in the ARRL handbook that Jim mentioned, There is a small wall that goes out there, but most of your power is radiated upward because you don't have any phasing stuff. Now, if you were to take and put phasing stubs in there, now you have a collinear type antenna using, let's say that so you would have three half waves and separated by a phasing stub. Now you get some gain. And it would be all perpendicular to the antenna on 15-meter band. That would be the, what could happen, then that would be, we weren't too good on 40 meters, because it would not be resonant, because you'd have all that wire and the phasing stuff, it would like just so much more extra wire, it wouldn't resonate on 40 meters at that point. That's what the difference is. Back to that, let me to Jake.
Okay. So, to take that one step further, we put the phasing sections in between each of the two, each of the two points between among the three half waves, there would be quarter wave, if you will, hairpins, and that would bring down the radiation angle of radiation for a vertical, and would be essentially three half waves stacked one on top of the other, each separated by a quarter wave hairpin. That'd be very cool. Get some extra gain. I think I saw something like that in the handbook. Alrighty. Well, that was good. Anybody else have any comments or questions related to this? Okay. Then, Mr. Noel, back to you.
Okay. I just think that at 440, the angle of radiation is higher. And I believe it was you that mentioned that if you wanted to, if you're using a 2-meter JPO at 440, you could tilt the antenna in the direction that you were trying to transmit and get probably a much better signal in the favored direction. Of course, you would probably cancel out completely what's behind you, because it would probably radiate pretty much straight up in the air. Okay, and now for the last question. Frankie, roller inductor, N2OEM.
Okay, I just want to give Jim a chance to see if he had any other follow-ups he wanted to say.
No more on that. But, if you take a look at the classic ZEP antenna, and look at the way it's designed, you can see how the thoughts went into the J-pole. But when you really get down to it, the J-pole is nothing more than a vertical half-wave dipole. So that's it. I have some comments on lubricating rotary inductors. I've done it, and there are things you got to be careful about. So back to that.
It's yours. Go for it. Go ahead, Jim.
Okay, no, I was just letting it drop there. Okay, that's K20. Well, first of all, Noel, is this a rotary inductor with a wire wound on a core so that there's some material between the turns, or are the turns sitting in free air?
They're wound on a core, so there's material between the turns and the OEL.
Okay, so now you have the opportunity for the debris to get in between there and cause some shorts. Okay. As the wheel turns on the, I have a couple of Johnson rotary inductors, and I have a couple of big Johnson rotary inductors. Now, the big ones, which sit free, okay, where there's no material on the core, they sit in free air. I lubricate them with molybdenum disulfide. Molybdenum disulfide greases is ideal. However, it's got a lot of particulates in it, and you don't want to get it, shorting between the turns. In a large rotary inductor, which I have, like the Johnson 203 here, it works fine. And it is an excellent lubricant, especially designed to work under pressure on metal parts. Is the noise coming from the wheel as it moves up and down the shaft, or is the noise coming from the wheel as it moves over the inductor itself? In other words, what I'm saying is that perhaps you can get rid of the noise by lubricating carefully with some lithium grease the shaft that the rotating wheel rides up and down on. Have you tried that?
No. The reason was, sometimes it's better to do nothing until you find the right advice because it might be hard to undo. I mean, I could get out liquid rinse, I could get tuner cleaner, and I could mess the thing up. So I decided to ask first and lubricate later. The noise seems to be coming from where it's spinning on the shaft as it goes up and down. I don't believe the noise is coming from the end bearing, because as I said, I lubricated them, they seem fine. And it doesn't seem to be coming from where the little wheel presses against the inductor itself, N2OEO.
Okay, well, what I'd do is I would lubricate that shaft first and see what happens. Lithium grease is pretty good. Lithium grease really is kind of a stearate. It's more like soap than anything else, and you can remove it. You don't want to use anything like molybdenum disulfide or anything that has entrained materials in it, because they'll get into the substrate and you'll never get them out of there. So also, if you realize on an inductor that the voltage between the end of the inductor, let's say, could be rather high in a matchbox. However, the voltage between individual turns is probably not. So you don't have that much of a problem, but still you don't want to get something in there. I would try lubricating the shaft that the roller rides on first. And then if that doesn't work, then maybe very carefully lubricating the wheel, the part of the wheel that goes over the wire, but very, very sparingly. And again, no graphite grease.
Okay, anybody else have any comments? Back to you, Noel.
No, I'm fine. I got some white lithium grease. I'll try that on the shaft first. I presume I should put it on the roller inductor itself. Is that true, Jim?
No, don't do that. Put it on there. Just put it on that shaft as to where that the wheel rolls on, and see if that indeed may be solving the problem.
Won't I be making an insulator?
Not really, because the pressure of the metal against it will do it. It's just like coax connectors. I flood the coax connectors with Dow silicone grease, the heavy, thick silicone grease that looks like Vaseline, and I take those connectors apart 10 years later, and they're like new. But because what I've done is remove all the entrained air so no moisture can get in, and yet the connector has enough contact area. I learned that trick from the cable TV guy.
I got to get some of that grease in my connections, too. Thank you. Back to that. This is N2OEO.
Okay. Well, we got a bonus answer on that one. Silicone grease to just, flood the connectors to keep them clean. I've actually had some pretty good luck by using, now I forget which one it is, but one of the 3M tapes, 2422, I forget which one it is. It's a rubber tape, but I've been using that, and I've been very, very lucky. Connectors have been very, very dry, and no problem. I moved away from vinyl tape to rubber because when you yank on it, it's self-adhesing and self-vulcanizing. I mean, you end up having to cut it off. Because it just kind of adheses and becomes one with itself. But anyway, I guess that's a question I should raise before we move on, because I do have a question for you, Jim. Okay, I guess you have no comment about the use of the self-vulcanizing rubber tape?
No, I have that. I use that. In fact, I use that quite liberally on my stepper antenna. Yes, that works quite well. If you want to, though, if you use good number 33 tape, the Scotch tape, and take a little bit of urethane goop and rub it on over there with your finger, you'll be amazed at how effective that is. The polyurethane will seal it forever.
That's true. Yeah, I've actually used Scotch 33. I tend to use that on weekends and stuff that's going to be temporary, but certainly silicone over anything is a good thing. In fact, in a similar method to what you do, is I've been known to take just one layer of tape and put it down and then go up near the, let's say it's a connector, I'll go up to the edge of the connector, I'll silicone it, I'll smear the outside with a little bit of silicone, and then put another tape layer or so over it, and basically trap the silicone in between, you know, the RTV, in between two layers of tape. And I find that is another good way of handling things, because that way you're not having to pull the silicone directly out of the connector. You got a tape layer underneath it, but you've sealed it up pretty well. That's another approach. You gotta be careful with it, because what you don't want to do is you don't want to end up with a capillary feed off the end. So that's why you gotta make sure that the edge of the tape is siliconed really, really well. But anyway, my question to you has to do with taking, basically improving one's 40 meter, possibly 75, but mostly 40 meter mobile signal. And this could also apply to a backyard situation. I have a High Sierra Sidekick, which is a short screwdriver antenna. I have a hamstick, well, actually I have a short hamstick at that, for 40 meters. And, you know, they work, I would say, generally speaking, the screwdriver works a little bit better, only because I can tune it to exactly where I want it in the band, and I also, it has a bigger diameter than the hamstick does. So I was thinking of either taking a 4 or 6, or God forbid, I have a 12-inch piece of PVC pipe, and taking a big honking conductor, let's say number 12, or even maybe something larger, insulated wire, and wrapping a coil. And then putting a stinger on top, just like you would a hamstick. And I was thinking of doing that as a way to, you know, shall we say, have a bigger antenna where it's less compressed and the coil has more surface area. And I was wondering what the practical limitations of that are. Is it 4? Is it 6 inches? Is it, you know, is it, you know,
repeater, sign out. Repeater, sign out. Cancel.
I'll get it in a second. Okay, so what I was thinking is, you know, even at 12 inches or 10 or 12 inches, I forget how big the PVC pipe is, but, you know, I could take a chunk of that and make a very nice coil and stick it on my roof rack. I mean, this is not something everybody wants to put on their vehicle because of aesthetics, but I have my roof rack. So from the performance viewpoint, what might be advantageous for 40 meters and what I'll call steroidal coils?
Well, if you look at the mobile handbook, they've got some very interesting concepts and ideas on doing that, moving a coil up there. For instance, let's say I just take a random length of vertical and I tune it with a tuner. I've got a very reactive antenna. It may be extremely low impedance and have lots of reactance and lots of loss. If I then break that antenna halfway up and put a coil and start to get it close to being resonant, as I do that, the impedance goes up. If I manage to bring that impedance up by just a few ohms, the efficiency is going to go up by a significant amount. If you go back and take a look at the Texas bug catcher, there's the answer right there. That's exactly what that did. And of course, by putting the top hat on it, the stinger, what you're able to do is effectively lengthen the antenna a little bit more. And, the impedance is going to get easier to drive the higher the impedance, in other words, moving up off of 4 ohms or so, the better off you're going to be.
and I can use my handy-dandy MFJ antenna analyzer to help me determine what those characteristics are. So that would work.
So what you're going to find is that if you put more coil up there, and you put the little top hat or stinger, whatever you want to call it, on there, you're going to see the impedance go up, and that's what you want, because feeding a very low 3 or 2 ohm impedance is not what most antenna tuners want to see, and they're very lossy at that point. If you remember that article that the QST did with random antenna loads where they tested antenna tuners, some of them were rather inefficient at those low impedances.
Okay, very good. Yeah. Well, I would attempt to have something that's a electrical quarter wavelength, somewhat like a, you know, a sidekick, but I would just make it bigger. I mean, so if I can make the coil bigger, it'll be less reactive. I say bigger, meaning bigger conductors, not as tightly wound, things like that. I guess at some point the antenna, when you twist it, you know, becomes, you know, it loses many of its magnetic field properties in the circular direction, and it becomes more linear, which probably is also a good thing, because that probably also has some reactive implications, does it not?
Yeah. And, of course, the other thing that you're forgetting about is the Q of the antenna. The larger the coil, the bigger the diameter, the lower the Q, the better off you are. Believe it or not, CBers found that out a long time ago. That's why you see these 5-watt CBs running into large diameter coils that they use. If you've ever noticed them, they like to impress people with them, but in reality, they actually work quite well because their Q is quite low.
Yeah, do you really think they're 5 watts?
I'm being a little facetious there.
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed that. All right, very good. Anybody else have any comments on the subject? Well, I started. Let me let the drop. I think I have either a 4 or 6 inch PVC pipe that it's probably, I don't know, maybe 3 feet long. And somewhere I think inside of it I put the remnants of a ham stick that had beaten itself up. So basically I have a piece of fiberglass rod with a little metal stinger holder at the top and a little piece of wire off what used to be the coil of the ham stick. I think I screwed that into into the PVC. So I don't know where I put that. I'll have to go look at the garage for that puppy. But once I find it, I'll reevaluate the wire I have on it, and we'll go from there. We'll do it a little more intelligently, and we'll experiment with that. If that works better, then maybe we'll try the big 10 or 12 inch piece of PVC. Although that thing's 5 feet high, so I haven't decided I really want to cut that. I was actually saving that for maybe a ground-mounted 160-meter antenna or something. But we'll see. All right. Anybody else have any comments about big antennas? The mobile. Or even home. Verticals. All right. Well, that's pretty good. Let's do this. Let's take some check-ins and see if there are any more check-ins. Any other questions that have come up? And then I'll go on to the two topics I mentioned earlier. Anybody would like to check in, please call K2BAR with your call sign, your name. Whether or not you have a question or comment, or just hanging out, please call K2BAR. Alrighty, nothing heard. Anybody else have any questions? Okay, we have an announcement. Tony, do you want to make the announcements for this weekend? Jim, do you want to make the club announcements then? NS2K.
Tony here.
Tony, you
you make the weekend announcements then?
Sorry, I was over on the other side of the shack here. Well, obviously, this coming Sunday is the Barra meeting, and among the things happening this week, this coming weekend, is the this coming Sunday meeting, is the election. If anybody would like to put forward a name to run for one of the executive positions or for one of the board members, you can do that at the meeting only this coming Sunday. After the nominations and any other submissions are evaluated, they'll have a vote. So the vote will be basically, if there aren't any other replacements for the existing board as it stands that the current vice president, president, treasury, and secretary have expressed the desire to continue in their position, but anybody can be nominated to compete with them if they like to. There is one position open, and that's for a executive board member. Every 3 years, we elect one executive board. So we have a rotating board with experienced hands at all times. So there's one position open for an executive board, and that will be has to be selected from nominations or from the floor. So that's basically the club business. The program for this weekend is going to be a visiting member of the ARL. I think he's called the our local section manager. I'm not too sure if that's correct designation. Obviously not Steve, and not Joyce. So Valkyrie is our section manager, and I don't know his name. Sorry. He will be making a presentation to the Barra Club. So it's Sunday night. As you know, it's, the doors open around 7, the meeting starts around 7:45. I think I covered all I can at this point, so back to you then. Or to pick it up.
That's interesting that Rich is coming up here. Okay. Oh, that'll be fun. He seems like a nice guy. But I've only had a couple of phone conversations with him. And one very odd letter, which will remain not the subject of discussion on Sunday, I can assure you. Anyway, let's see. Any other upcoming activities people want to talk about?
We do have an up-and-coming Hudson Division dinner on November the 8th, Sunday at noontime. It's not dinner, it's a luncheon. Hudson Division luncheon at November the 8th at 12 noon. We held at Diageo's restaurant. We were trying to fill a table of 10 Barra members. And last count I had heard, we had to eat only. If we get 10, then we all get a discount of $5, and it comes on $45 per member. I don't know what they'll do if we don't get a full 10 members, because I only mailed in $45. But $50 normally if you attend as a single on your own isolated non-Barra entrance. But it's $45 if you can get it up, get it to Barra by this weekend. I think it's the last possible collection day for that. So that's November the 8th. It's Sunday, and it's 12 noon at the Diageo's restaurant. And of course, they will be collecting money for the Barra dinner, $25, and that's about half the price of the dinner. Actually, Barra will be paying half, and the members they attend to pay the other half, $25 for dinner on the first Sunday in December, a normal Barra meeting, and this time we call it an awards dinner. It's not a holiday dinner or a Christmas dinner or anything else, it's an awards dinner. So I'm looking at the calendar, I could probably come up with a date, but it's the first Sunday in December. December the 6th, there we go. So that's $25. So bring two checks, one for the Hudson Division, one for the Barra dinner. Yeah, along the way, at the end of November, don't forget the Fair Lawn auction on the Friday night after Thanksgiving. How about that, Gordon? Pick it up.
That's excellent. That's most excellent. The Fair Lawn auction is what, the day after Thanksgiving?
The Friday night after Thanksgiving.
Yeah,
logistical arrangements to make sure we're there, but we will be there with bells on. That's a lot of fun. Just get some food, get some auction time going. It's a lot of fun. A good time is had by all. Just an aside, there's also subject to a test team manifesting itself. They're still working on that. The Tuesday after Christmas, there will be a one-day technician course, as long as we can get a test team together, and I'm working on that. So keep that in mind, and it should be great fun, to say the least, to see some new hams on the air. And what else? I think that's about it. With that, so let me drop it, see if there's anybody else who wants to come out with a question or comment, and I'll go to our two topics. Anybody want to check in? Okay. Alrighty. So there's been a lot of conversation, for lack of a better term, as to whether or not it is wise to have emergency management agencies, non-governmental agencies, and also private businesses that are doing what I'll call business continuity communications in a disaster, whether or not they can use amateur radio while on their payroll. And the FCC is pretty clear about it. They don't care whether or not you're on the payroll at that point or not. If it's your business, you can't do it. They've made a bit of an exception, but they require a waiver. Let me drop it. And it's not last week they came up with a waiver process for governmental agencies, basically, to apply. And, you know, right now, I think the state of Kentucky made sure that its two employees who are hams could be on the payroll and, you know, also operate the state RACES net or the state emergency management net in non-RACES mode. And their waiver was granted in about 48 hours, which is pretty cool. But even if it took several weeks, it's lightning fast. But there is a waiver process now. And so, you know, inform your OEMs in particular that if they are paid, they have a pecuniary interest, as they say, then you have to make sure this waiver process is followed and documented, because what they don't want is amateur radio to become, should we say, a default spillover radio service for governments that don't want to spend money on traditional Part 90 radio services that cost a lot more money in the way of equipment and licensing fees and coordination and such. There was a webinar that the Atlantic Division ran yesterday, and I think that might be available. Most of their webinars are available later on CD or DVD with the PowerPoint slides and the audio. So that's another thing you might consider. But I know we've been expanding our RACES and OEM activities, and that we don't have an ARIES anymore, although right now the Ramsey OEM is sort of standing in on that. But I think at this point our you know, amateur radio MCOM capabilities are basically leveraging heavily off of RACES operators who are now OEM operators, and that's pretty much the way it is. But there's great concern as we expand that, you know, jurisdictions might consider not ramping up their Part 90 requirements, but doing something via amateur radio because they think they can do it legally, where they really can't. One mayor who is a ham in a southern state which will remain nameless after Katrina called Dan Henderson up at the league and said, "Hey, our area was not served by any 2-meter repeaters, so We're in the process of buying one, along with 25 two-meter radios to put in all the municipal vehicles. And so we'll have amateur radio available to us no matter what vehicle anyone's in. And he wanted to know Mr. Henderson's opinion of that. And he provided more than opinion. He provided chapter and verse on the subject that stuff's got to be used by amateur radio operators, and there's all sorts of other concerns, blah, 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 blah. So this is how crazy and far afield it can become, even among licensed amateurs who mean well. But if you want to lose your frequencies to other services permanently, then you give them undue entree to the frequencies without the expertise in the normal operative package of a ham radio operator, then which is more than a license, then you're looking to basically cede your frequencies away, and that's the concern of the league on this point, and I think it's well-founded. What they did say was that you don't want to forego your obligation to serve your community should there be a need, and that's the point. So use common sense, and if something can reasonably be accommodated by another radio service, then it should be done by that other radio service. And if it has to be done by amateur radio because of the timeliness issues related to life and property, or just a total lack of other facilities, let's say in a post-Katrina kind of mode, then fine, do what you got to do. But ask yourself the operative questions as to whether or not there are alternatives available that are reasonable for a timely and effective delivery of the traffic. Having said that, are there any questions? Anybody else have any thoughts on the subject?
72JEK.
Mr. Don, go right ahead. W2JEK, K2BAR.
I did see some of this on the website about the Kentucky drill. And I do believe that this is what this waiver is for. It's for the use of amateur radio by employees during a drill. They're on the payroll. They're using amateur radio to enable communications where other communications might have failed. This is during the drill. Now, in a real-time, unless to go on emergency where you have, let's say, a telephone central office that's completely out of service, such as Rochelle Park was during the Hurricane Floyd, or other central office failures, East 13th Street, Hillsdale, among others, an actual out-and-out emergency, that would, I think they said it.
Yeah, the waiver is primarily for the drill, drill mode, or should we say non-emergency mode, but they spent a lot of time on the webinar last night emphasizing that even in an actual emergency, ask yourself if there's a reasonable, way to handle this traffic another way, without unduly delaying the traffic or at any, increased risk of to life and property. So there are other elements of this too. They didn't want it just to become a panacea. They wanted, people to understand that even in an emergency there are issues that could arise. So that should be thought through a little bit. Okay.
I guess you have to understand is what they consider an emergency.
We doubled a little bit. What would be considered an emergency? A breakdown in effective communication, so like the kinds of things you talked about. So let me give you an example. I like this particular example. There was a flood 2.5 years ago. Bunch of COs down, a bunch of cell sites down, power was down along Hackensack River coming out of the reservoir. And we all know that communications was stressed, and things like that. So it was entirely reasonable to deal with Red Cross, Red Cross, traffic in the, you know, disposition of the of their clients for the first 24 hours or so. Had that been for 3 weeks when other stuff was available, probably not at that point. Could you use it in and around, let's say, a shelter? Had the shelter stayed open for 3 or 4 days? Sure. As it happened, it stayed open for 2 nights, and that was it. So, you know, but by the morning of the second morning, it was, you know, everybody was going home or going someplace else. So, but you don't need amateur radio at that point, and everybody was discharged. So, in general, they just advise caution and prudence, and there's no hard and fast rule, but don't give away the store and run the risk of not having not having your frequencies available should they simply be requisitioned by a compelling social need who would be hard to say no to, but got their foot in the door. You know, it's kind of like the camel's nose got into the tent. So you got to make sure that you know whether or not you're letting him in the tent or you're letting him near the tent. And, you know, we want to let him near the tent but not in it. Did that answer your question, Tom?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a life or death kind of situation where you have a central office out of service, such as Ocean Park was during Hurricane Floyd. It was down Thursday night. It was up Sunday afternoon because they had taken the power off the central office equipment so that it would not go sputtering when the water hit the power panel down in the basement. So they pulled the switch. And they rerouted some power cables from another power room into that central office and got it up and running again. But in the meantime, we were doing communications for the Red Cross on our amateur frequencies. They had fire shelters going at one point. And I started with them on Saturday afternoon. They still had two shelters afloat. I going, and they closed one while I was on duty. Now, Red Cross has their own business frequencies that they use. But they got the extra help, I guess, is what we looked at this place, an extra help during an actual emergency. For that duration of that time when the shelter was open. Of course, I also heard the rumor that somebody in there would pass away because they could not summon a doctor because the phones were out. That Maywood subscriber is fed by the Rochelle Park Central Office. Another thought on that is you have a potential life or death emergency that somebody might need a doctor, and you've got 50,000 telephones down out of service. Is that an emergency? Would we be advised to assist during that period of time? Because there might be an emergency, let's put it that way. I guess it's somewhere along the line. It's a gray area in there, I guess. This is W2JK back to that.
I think you hit a nail on the head. Any communications network failure that does not have, that leaves the public exposed to life or property issues, we could be engaged quite reasonably, and we should be engaged. Sometimes we're not because our local governments don't necessarily feel the need, but hey, that's not my call. Yeah, good point. Next one was,
next topic was pretty straightforward. Apparently, there was a